Podcast and Google Podcast. À la prochaine.
This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, June 6, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. If you've been tuning into Rabble Radio for a while, you'll know that every summer we return to a familiar and vital discussion. Climate change is a labor issue. In the past, we've spoken about how extreme weather events affect working Canadians, how climate change affects agricultural workers and the economy, and we've chatted with advocates in Ottawa calling for a national firefighting agency. There's no debate, climate change and labor are intrinsically linked. Today on Rabble Radio, we're spotlighting an organization in British Columbia calling for the implementation of a maximum working temperature. The Worker Solidarity Network is urging the provincial government to introduce legislation that would protect workers from the dangers of extreme heat on the job. Currently, BC has no regulations in place to set temperature limits in workplaces, but with the increasing threat of deadly heat waves, advocates say the time for action is now. Here is Jiyun Ha, Communications Coordinator at the Worker Solidarity Network, in conversation with Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Jiyun.
Yeah, thank you so much for hosting me.
Could you introduce yourself and the Worker Solidarity Network?
Yeah, so my name is Jiyun Ha. I'm the communications coordinator at the Worker Solidarity Network. And the Worker Solidarity Network, or WSN for short, is a small BC-based nonprofit that helps precarious and non-unionized workers. And we do so through three pillars of our work, which is through Know Your Rights education, our legal advocacy program, in which we help workers through the Employment Standards Branch complaints process, and also campaigning for long-term change. And this campaign, this Too Hot to Work campaign, is an example of us advocating for long-term change.
Yeah, so let's get into that Too Hot to Work campaign a little bit more. What is it that you're calling for specifically?
This campaign has had kind of many iterations over the last 3 years. So we first called for a myriad of different Too Hot to Work policies, but we've kind of focused it this year to having a maximum working temperature.
Nice. Interesting. And so what brought you guys, can you tell me about some of the other calls, I guess, that were out there and what brought you to like bringing it into this focus?
Yeah. Originally, our call did include maximum working temperature. It also included things like climate paid leave and free and affordable public transit for workers to safely get to work, and open work permits and minimum wage increases, 15 paid sick days, and improving access to unionization for precarious workers. And these are all causes that we still firmly believe in, but we think that the most pertinent and urgent call is to call for a maximum working temperature.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more of that. What is it that you're hoping to see to you know, implement that long-term change?
To implement a maximum working temperature, we would want to ensure that vulnerable at-risk communities, including migrant workers and workers with disabilities, are adequately protected during extreme heat, because they often face different challenges than your typical worker when it comes to working in the heat. We also want to see that health and safety procedures, including access to hydration, shade, and cooling during above average heat temperatures, are implemented. We want to see additional breaks for redress during extreme heat and heat domes, particularly for at-risk workers, including outdoor workers, workers engaged in strenuous work, workers on 12-hour shifts, and workers required to wear heavy clothing or gear. We also want to see access to PPE, so personal protective equipment, and thermometers to assist workers in staying safe and assessing heat conditions at work sites. And we want to see the inclusion of a robust enforcement policy. So it's one thing to have these heat assessment practices or policies, but it's another thing to make sure they're actually being practiced or enforced by employers. So we want to mandate the conduction of 1,000 workplace inspections relating to heat exposure. And we've actually received a lot of complaints that came in during the 2021 heat dome. So maybe starting with those work sites.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of interesting points that you kind of come into. Like, a lot goes into implementing specifically this like maximum temperature call that you guys have. I'm curious also, you talked a bit about some of the other calls that have existed through this campaign in the past. What led you guys to decide that, you know, this specific one is the urgent one to kind of put your force behind in this moment?
I think that these, like a maximum working temperature, is kind of at the forefront of what workers experience on the daily and have experienced for the last few years. All of these demands were derived from a focus group that we had in 2022, I believe, and that's included in our climate and labor report that's on our website called Can't Stand the Heat, Get Out of the Kitchen, in which our climate and labor project coordinator, Jen Kostachuk, who's actually not with the WSN team anymore, but she conducted these focus groups. And these demands came from what these workers reported on having experienced during the 2021 heat dome.
Can you tell me a bit more about that? You mentioned also like getting some reports during the 2022 like heat dome and all these things. So what is it that you've been hearing, and what were kind of some of the stories that galvanized you to be like, this is urgent?
A lot of workers reported that, you know, they fainted on the job. It was normalized for them to go into the walk-in freezer to cool off. They were expected to show up when wildfire smoke was happening and they had their jobs required to work on an outdoor patio. Yeah, just like, and also the financial pressure of workers not being able to make the choice for their health because they couldn't afford to. They had to show up regardless of what the weather was like or what they had to put their bodies through because they needed that day's money, you know, to pay their bills and just to put food on the table, as one worker stated.
Yeah, and that's a really good point you make there, is a lot of workers are being pushed into this position where they have to choose between like health and a paycheck. So how do you hope to kind of, you know, fight for both of those things, health and a paycheck, through this campaign?
Well, yeah, we're hoping that this maximum working temperature will make it a lot easier in ensuring the health and safety of workers so that they shouldn't have to even choose between getting a paycheck versus choosing their health and not fainting at work. No one should ever have to choose between those two things. And I think that the reason why this maximum working temperature has been, why we've been pushing the maximum working temperature so much, is because all workers just deserve a safe and healthy workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's really important to continue to push for those kinds of calls. I'm curious also, so we've talked a lot about kind of the info that came out of the Can't Stand the Heat, Get Out of the Kitchen report, which really focuses on 2022. But I'm wondering, you know, what are some of the things workers are facing now, 3 years later? And like, what are the stories that have come in that have, you know, encouraged you to continue carrying out this campaign?
Yeah, so I am not familiar with the specific stories because I'm not part of the legal advocacy team. But what I have been seeing is that a lot of workers just don't even know their basic rights, whether it's to do with heat stress or not at all. Based on our Know Your Rights workshops, a lot of comments we receive are, I experienced this and I didn't even know I was allowed to refuse unsafe work without proof. I didn't know that I had these rights. And so, well, I'm not sure about the specific stories that have come in since 2022. This is a common pattern that we see in a lot of precarious workers, in which they kind of lack the education to protect themselves.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a an important trend to note is that people aren't even aware of the rights that they have available to them, even like without, you know, implementing the calls that you guys are putting forward. I'm curious, can you tell me a bit about what are the rights that workers have currently, and how does implementing like this maximum temperature call add to those rights?
Yeah, so with regards to heat stress, in BC, there's actually very little protections around it. I think a lot of policies are really outdated and were created way before climate change has really taken a hold of our world and our working conditions. Currently, BC has very reactive politics that only kick in when an employee's core temperature hits 38 degrees Celsius. And a fever is generally considered to be 38 to 39.9 degrees Celsius. So that's a pretty severe and intense core body temperature to expect. And we think that there should be more preventative and proactive policies to prevent this from even happening in the first place. 38 degrees, we feel that the damage is already done. In particular, if it's in conjunction with wildfire smoke, you know, workers can already have inhaled a lot of wildfire smoke. They shouldn't have to have incurred these damages to be able to step away from work. And I think that currently the Ministry of Labor has responded to this campaign and recently saying that they wouldn't be regulating workplace temperature because heat stress and injury are caused by a combination of things such as humidity, radiant heat, physical demands of work, individual health, hydration, and clothing. And because of that complexity, they don't and will not set a specific indoor temperature limit. But what we're calling for, maximum working temperature, addresses all of these things. It addresses humidity, it addresses physical demands of work, individual health, hydration, and clothing. So we're not really sure what they mean by that.
That's interesting that you bring that up as well. I know in some of our previous talks before we had started this interview, we talked about how these kinds of like maximum working temperature kind of calls have been implemented in other jurisdictions. So I'm wondering, you know, you're saying the government, the BC government is pushing back a bit on this call. Does what they're saying make sense in comparison to kind of what is being done in other jurisdictions that actually do have these kinds of protections?
It absolutely doesn't make any sense because workers around the world, around the globe, have experienced heat stress. And this includes people in Japan, in Portugal, in Spain, and even our neighbors down in Washington State. But those governments have reacted and have since implemented policies at the workplace, consulting experts in labor, experts in climate, to react to the fact that a lot of their citizens have died from extreme heat on the job, have died from heat stroke. One example is Japan. As of March of this year, 2025, their health ministry has actually mandated businesses to create protocols around heat strokes and will hold businesses who fail to do so criminally liable. Their maximum temperature is 31 degrees Celsius for over 1 hour or a total of 4 hours or more within a day. And this comes after a record high of 1,195 people who were sick from heat illnesses last year with 30 deaths. In Spain, Spain has very strict heat thresholds, clear enforcement, and seems to be one of the best examples of an implementable heat policy. And their heat policy says a temperature between 17 and 27 degrees is required for work in an office, while work that requires light physical effort should be performed at a temperature between 14 to 25 degrees Celsius.
It sounds like from these examples, there is a way to implement these kind of maximum working temperatures.
Yeah. Even in Washington, which may have perhaps the most comparable climate and environmental conditions as BC, they've been quick to revise their ambient heat exposure rules, which was initially put into place in 2008, but they revised it in July of 2023. So that was 2 years ago. And these rules are aimed at protecting outdoor workers from excessive heat and include required access to cool down periods, preventative cool down periods, lower temperature action levels, and protective actions are required at 80 degrees Fahrenheit or for most outdoor workers. And so we're seeing around multiple states in the United States and multiple jurisdictions in Europe and Japan that this is very possible, and it is the humane thing to do to react and try to take preventative action and learn from what has happened. And it's not really a stretch or insane ask to ask that workers don't die on the job and get sick on the job. We've seen it happen around so many jurisdictions around the globe that it feels like something so standard, especially for a province that I think really touts itself as being progressive and like the world's greenest city and all things like that, at least for Vancouver.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like there is this kind of, I guess, reputation that maybe isn't being lived up to in this case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm curious also, you know, we've talked a lot about like in other countries, kind of the type of like heat protections that exist. I know in Ontario, there was in 2024, there was a bill tabled also calling for more heat protections. I'm wondering, you know, how can Canadians, not just in BC, but across the country, kind of unite to advance this call?
I would say if we're seeing an example in our own country with our neighbors in the East Coast, then that kind of amplifies the message that this is needed here in Canada and this is implementable in Canada. And we should follow their example in having like this bigger standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like it really is, like you said, it's about raising the standard of work for workers in BC, but also all over Canada. I'm curious also, as you've been carrying this out, we've talked a bit about, you know, the response from the BC government, for example. What has been the response from workers themselves? Do they see themselves in this campaign and their needs being reflected?
Yes, I believe so. I would hope so. I think a lot of the workers that we try to approach, we do a lot of outreach to try and target especially food service workers, because we know that food service is one of the most precarious industries. Some food service workers report that they do have air conditioning, but a lot of outdoor workers that I think are slightly harder for us to access, such as construction workers, agricultural workers, they see themselves reflected more. And I think that there is a bigger disconnect because these workers are often, I think, a lot more isolated, and sometimes, a lot of the time actually, they can also be migrant workers. And so sometimes there are language barriers that kind of prevent them further from knowing what their rights are, or perhaps they're more scared to mobilize because their status is connected to their work. But based on the research that we did and some of our allies in migrant workers action centers, I believe that this is something that workers see themselves in and see themselves experiencing and as something that they could really benefit from.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like, you know, there's a really strong basis for putting forward these calls and continuing to fight this fight. Well, we're about to head into summer, and you've mentioned there has been some pushback from the government. So what's next to ensure that this campaign continues to move forward and that workers' rights are respected, especially as we get into the warmer months?
I'm so glad you asked. We recently had a shift in the movement of our campaign. So in the last year, we've really focused on collecting a lot of signatures that we actually collected and sent to Premier Eby, Minister of Labor, Jennifer Whiteside, and Minister of Health, Josie Osborne. So we have already shown them that I believe like over 1,000 letters were sent to them. Like, so we've shown them that workers are calling for this change. And while they may stay kind of mum about this, we're moving our campaign to the next stage where we are going to be taking more direct actions. An example of this was the rally that we held two Fridays ago in front of David Eby's office. We had a giant scroll that actually had a list of all of the petition signers, and it was a long scroll. I think we're focused more on mobilizing our membership to educate their own communities about this campaign, about their rights. We're hoping to expand into communities that speak other languages other than English. And I think the focus from here on will just be trying to connect with more workers and creating like a more creating more visibility directly to show people that this is not okay and they deserve better.
Yeah, for sure. And what can supporters who are listening to this right now, whether they're in BC or in other provinces, what can they do to support these calls and to support this campaign?
I think that it would be powerful for them to write letters or call on either ministers and politicians in BC for such for heat protections, or even calling on their own like local MLAs in their provinces, so that you know, we can create this Canada-wide movement where we see these heat protections, like kind of following suit with Ontario, that this is something that Canadians do need. And yeah, and I think if in for people in Vancouver who are, or in Victoria who are perhaps closer to our events and actions, coming out to these actions and just learning more about what their own rights are and talking to their communities about what they can do to protect themselves as well.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
That was Jiyun Ha from the Worker Solidarity Network in British Columbia and labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Jiyun. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with news from Palestine. Rabble freelance reporter Anna Lipman recently returned from a fact-finding mission in the West Bank. What Lipman saw was an increased oppression from the Israeli government, along with growing violence from illegal Israeli settlers against Palestinians. Lipman spoke with Palestinian farmers who had their livestock stolen by Israeli settlers. Palestinians in the West Bank face constant harassment and violence, both from settlers and from the Israeli military. In addition to failing to stop the violence perpetrated against them by settlers, the Israeli government often arbitrarily arrests and detains Palestinian civilians. Approximately 40% of all Palestinian men will be incarcerated at one point in their life, and for Palestinian women, that number is around 20%. Meanwhile, the violence in neighboring Gaza continues, with Israel continuing harsh restrictions on the importation of food into the region. In environmental news, a Quebec community is pushing back against an American corporation and their local government in a bid to protect their region from industrial contamination. Stablex, a U.S.-based waste disposal company, is seeking to expand one of its dumping sites in Blainville, Quebec, into a nearby wetland. Protesters fear that not only would an important environmental area supporting biodiversity be destroyed, but that the site could pose a potential health hazard for people living in the area. Environmental groups opposing Stablex claim that most of the waste that they process is not produced locally, but is imported, with at least a third coming from the U.S., according to their estimates. They also say that testing done on water around the facility shows elevated levels of cadmium, a cancer-causing mineral. Stablex disputes both of these claims. Staying with environmental news, a new report shows that Ontario is falling behind in its commitments to preserve biodiversity. The report from the Ontario Biodiversity Council shows that the province is failing to make progress on many of its commitments. In 2005, the province set out more than 15 criteria to monitor the protection of biodiversity. Some of these criteria include civic engagement. While 80% of the province claims to know what biodiversity is, only 25% of those surveyed by the council said that they would volunteer to help support biodiversity issues. Just as worrying, the council noted that the number of endangered species in the province as of January of last year was 268, a 25% increase from 2020. Also this week, Alberta NDP leader Naheed Nenshi continues to trail in the polls behind Premier Danielle Smith. Recent polling shows that nearly half of Albertans would still vote for Danielle Smith if the election were held today. This despite Naheed Nenshi's popularity with his base and Danielle Smith's controversial public comments and scandals. Since January, Smith's government has been under intense public scrutiny after the CEO of Alberta Health Services, Athana Menzelopoulos, was abruptly fired. Menzelopoulos alleges that she was fired after investigating unfavorable contracts that Alberta Health Services had signed with friends and family members of Danielle Smith's United Conservative Party. On top of this scandal has been Smith's repeated threats to allow a referendum on Alberta's separation from Canada. And finally, Dave Suzuki is saying that the world must push back against ignorance if progress is to be made on the climate crisis. Suzuki points to U.S. President Donald Trump as one of the most obvious examples of a politician pushing ignorant anti-climate pseudoscience. Theories pushed by the president that climate change is a hoax are false and dangerous. Here in Canada, too, however, there are politicians who are not taking the threat of climate change seriously. A notable example is how almost all federal parties refuse to oppose further development of Canada's fossil fuel industry. Suzuki says that to save the planet, fossil fuels must remain in the ground. As always, you can read all the stories that we talked about today on rabble.ca.
This April, Rabble.ca proudly celebrated 24 years of delivering news for the rest of us. While we are heartened by the progress we've made, independent journalism like ours still relies on the steadfast support of listeners like you. That's why our annual summer fundraising campaign remains a vital part of sustaining our work. We've set a summer fundraising goal of $10,000. These funds will directly support the editors, contributors, and reporters who bring you independent journalism that informs, inspires, and holds power to account. Whether it's $1, $10, or $1,000, your support makes a difference. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
That's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.